You're listening to a podcast by the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development.
Let me now start with Beatrice Alain. Beatrice is the coordinator of the international network called RELIES, which was established by the Chantier de l'Économie Sociale in Quebec. She wrote the paper together with Marguerite Mendel, a professor at the School of Community and Public Affairs of the Carl Polanyi Institute at Concordia University. And Beatrice will speak about the effectiveness of collaborative processes. Beatrice.
Good morning. So Margie Mendel is in the room and co-authored this with me, so anyone who has questions can refer to her or to me afterwards. Do we have a... Yep. So I'm going to talk about evaluating the formation of enabling public policy for the social economy. The paper was based on 14 case studies. Four were done for the OECD by Margie Mendel and others, and the other 10 were done by FIES and RELIES, so coordinated by the Chantier de l'Économie Sociale. The FIES was the forum, the International Forum on the Social and Solidarity Economy. It took place in 2011, and these case studies looked at, they were national case studies that looked at public policy at the national, regional, and municipal level that enabled the social economy, and specifically focused on, looked at when there were cases of co-construction. And they were written by local practitioners in collaboration with local authors. And the RELIES case studies, the RELIES is the center that I coordinate that came out of the FIES, that looks again on public policy on the social and solidarity economy. So these case studies are similar to the FIES, they're written by local researchers and practitioners. And so the paper really was gathering together all of this information, most of it done by other people, and trying to see where the commonalities are and what we can say about public policy, given different institutional contexts. Obviously, there are different levels of economic and political institutions in these countries. Also, the case studies were done in specific periods in time, so some things have evolved. You can see Mali, there was a case study in 2011. There were several interesting initiatives, and unfortunately, given the situation there, not just the social economy, but many other things have stopped. So I thought I would define first what co-construction is. It's a highlighted process because it's more than a one instance effort. It's a process of policy formation and of policy design. We differentiate it from co-production, which is more about service delivery. It's really about a dialogue from the level, from designing and developing to implementing, evaluating the public policy that's there. There's a growing realization in the North and South that existing public policy is not able to deal with the increasingly complex issues that we're facing, and we need new innovative policy, not just in the kinds of policy that exist, but also the processes by which we develop this policy. And the social economy is particularly adapt to bring about this change because of its inherent complex nature. So it requires innovation from government. Okay, so we were looking at why co-construction was necessary. The social economy has impact that's beyond the scope of any one ministry. So countries where the focus or the interest in the social and solidarity economy was on one aspect, for example, its capacity to create employment, really missed out on the broader social, cultural, territorial development impact that the social and solidarity economy has. And only by having both a mix of broad enabling policies and then targeted policies at the sectoral level or targeting specific groups are we best able to really enable the full development of the social economy. If you have broad enabling policies without any targeted any policies that look at specific sectors where the social economy is present, then it may not be effective enough. At the same time, if you have targeted policies without any kind of broad framework, you miss out on enabling the full development and the full impact that the social economy can contribute. So ideally, all of these kinds of policies are working together and are articulated for the benefit of a specific local community. So again, the objective in the end for government is to ensure policy effectiveness. By having the dialogue between the actors and government, you ensure more innovative, more adapted, and more effective, ultimately, policy than those would be decided by one government instance, and which may not have the capacity to foresee all of the impact or all of the obstacles facing actors in the terrain. So again, by having continuous feedback, you reduce policy misalignments or incoherence that may emerge. And then having this sort of instituted flexibility allows for constant readjustment, and that's particularly important when you have stakeholders' commitment to policy success is weak. So there was in certain cases, in certain countries, for example, in Poland, there was a region that was that was more reticent to sort of government programs, that was had less institutional capacity, and by having the recommendation was by having more dialogue, by engaging civil society, you would ensure stakeholder commitment to the process and to the development of the social economy. So having this process of continuous dialogue reduces information asymmetry and transaction costs. For this, you need multi-stakeholder dialogue spaces. In some countries, this is very well developed. In Quebec, we have a tradition of having these tables de concertation, so spaces where different kinds of stakeholders can come together. In other places, they've been instituted punctually, so there'll be a conference or a standing conference. But by bringing together all of the actors that are affected by public policy for the social economy or that are in the social economy to discuss their needs, their challenges, the information circulates a lot faster. And again, the continuous feedback is important because not everyone can foresee the different challenges that will emerge as social and political context evolves or the social economy develops. And complex legal landscapes or innovative types of social economy enterprises increase this need to share information. So what we know about social and solidarity economy enterprises is that often they do adapt, take on innovative forms or address multiple needs at the same time, and you need to adjust existing legislation in order to fully enable them. And similarly, for example, access to finance was a big issue in many countries, and what we found was in certain instances involuntarily, but the measures that existed that were supposedly enabling the social and solidarity economy, certain kinds of enterprises didn't have access to financing because of their commercial nature, or didn't have access to a certain market because of their legal form that they took. So by having this discussion and by having the people on the terrain who are the first people affected able to provide feedback, it means that adjustment policy gets adjusted much faster. So looking at the requirements of for effective co-construction, representative networks and intermediary bodies are extremely important. We distinguish between networks and coalitions and other broad forms of representation. Networks tend to be networks of organization, a certain type of organization, so co-op networks or user networks in, for example, forest users. Coalitions tend to be broader, so they'll regroup different kinds of organizations, or they can bring together also social movements or other groups that may be interested in fostering alternative economic development. So for example, in Quebec, the labor movement and the women's movement are also sitting at the stakeholders' table to discuss how we can promote alternative forms of development. So networks are important and necessary, but not always sufficient if they're not taking into account the broad spectrum of organizations and realities that exist in the social and solidarity economy or that are interested in supporting it. And then measures to facilitate optimal integration. Really, both government and the social economy can act to enhance or to enable the strengthening of intermediary bodies or to weaken it. The social economy, in terms of coalitions that create, when there's bickering between groups or when certain groups are excluded or when intermediary bodies are not representative, that'll create conflict and competition. Especially in terms of government, when governments are arbitrarily including certain groups or deciding who is representing the social and solidarity economy, this will create competition. So we found in Burkina Faso, this was one of the critiques, was that the government would arbitrarily include sometimes one network or representative organization and sometimes another. In Ecuador, they had certain criteria. Again, so it was the government deciding, so that creates competition. And instead, in PACA and Provence Alpes Côte d'Azur, the government had made a really a very purposeful effort to foster the creation of networks and to encourage new organizations to join existing networks, and that again contributed to strengthening the capacity of the social and solidarity economy to speak together and to coordinate itself and to share resources. So if intermediary bodies are more in terms of the actors, government capacity and commitment is also important. In certain instances, the social and solidarity economy has been recognized as a key element of development strategy, and then government attention and resources have followed. This is especially the case in certain cases. There's been framework legislation, or in the case of Brazil, small-scale agriculture is seen as answering the need for food sovereignty, and so resources have been policy has been adapted. Has been adopted to foster and to enable small agricultural organizations. But there's also other aspects. So budgetary allocation have to follow. In certain countries, there was the interest in the social solidarity economy, but resources didn't follow. So the policy measures or programs would be adopted, but with no budgetary envelope. So that was the case in several instances in Poland and Bolivia. The government actors, so sometimes there's an interest in the social solidarity economy, but the agents who are mandated to carry this out are not sufficiently trained or informed on what this implies. And then ensuring continuity in government engagement is also an issue. Sometimes it's very linked to a specific political party or to a specific political interest, and then it becomes partisan and unstable. If the government falls, then there's a step back. So the more institutionally embedded the social economy is and the more it's recognized as answering the society's needs versus being the program of one government, the more chances it has that the process of co-construction and of dialogue will continue regardless of what government is in power. So because the social and solidarity economy, it goes beyond the scope of any one ministry, there's a need for intra-government collaboration, horizontal, so between departments or ministries. And again, when the social economy was limited to, when the interest was limited to one issue like employment, this was a problem because it would be carried by one ministry and there was no discussion with other impacts, so social, cultural, etc. Vertical, if there's no vertical collaboration between, so municipal, regional, national governments, that limits both the application of a national policy and the application of targeted regional or specific policy at the territorial level. And then there need to be links between these. Intergovernment collaboration is also important. So, for example, the EU, and I think there's a paper on Mercosur, and so these sort of multiple government frameworks need to also recognize the specificity of different countries and enable them, ideally. What we found in the case studies, for example, in Poland and in France, was that the EU tended to add another level of complexity, so it wasn't really supporting the efforts in those countries. Appropriate time horizons are important, so often there's an interest in sort of emergency measures, palliative measures, but the long-term planning is important. if all actors are just working to ensure their survival, they're not able to project into a medium term what they need to structurally develop. And the variability of government support is also important. In certain cases, for example, in Korea, there was a two-year financing plan, but then it doesn't go on to look at what happens after those 2 years. What we found in Quebec was that in the debates in the late 90s established that different types of enterprises need different kinds of support. So some are small but will scale up and they will become eventually completely autonomous or partially autonomous. Others are not destined to scale or really aren't destined to be autonomous financially, for example. Integrating handicapped people in the workplace, for example. So government needs to recognize the different kinds of financial and institutional support that they're providing, and more broadly shift the focus from expenditure to investment. So the question of social, of the impact that they're having, and how do we measure this impact as more than just a financial expenditure versus a return, but the social impact more generally. In conclusion, this is from the synthesis paper of the OECD and sort of looks at, there's a process of coordination ideally between all of these governments, so the supranational, national, regional, and local government. And then at all levels of government, ideally, there's processes of co-construction. So this is an ideal schema. It's not necessarily reality, but this is what we would like to see, ideally. In conclusion, co-construction decreases information asymmetry, increases ownership of policy, and facilitates implementation and adjustment. It requires independent and capable intermediaries, a willingness to break down silos between government, and I think this was addressed also yesterday, an ability to project into the longer run, both in terms on the government side and on the social economy. We looked briefly, we mentioned some of the challenges in the conclusion of the paper, of subsidiarity versus conditionality. So how do you ensure territorial reality and then compliance to ensure cohesion? Accountability in hybrid arrangements, if you're bringing together different types of actors, who's ultimately responsible? And questions of credibility of the social solidarity economy networks towards their members and towards government, that they're effectively representing the needs and demands of the social solidarity economy, and credibility in terms of government, that they are fully committed to this. A quick word on path dependency, because different countries have different levels of institutional development. What the case studies highlighted was that that affects how these processes come about, but it doesn't mean that these processes can't come about anywhere. It just takes different shapes and is more or less easy depending on the sector. In conclusion, anyone who's interested in any of these specific countries and the reality, you can find all of the national case studies on the Relies website, and those will go into more detail about the local and national realities in those countries. Thank you.
Check out our other podcasts available free on the iTunes Store. For more information, go to our website, www.unrhys.org. Thank you for listening.